on a clump of grass.
I never understood Father Griffin either, but he was angry when I did not. I was punished when I asked him why we must fast and pray for our sins, when Christ had already forgiven them. And he said I'd been taught heathendom, and made Mother send me to my room. What is heathendom, Aunt?
It is anything a priest doesn't like, said Morgaine. Father Griffin is a fool. Even the best of the Christian priests do not trouble little ones like you, who can do no sin, with much talk about it. Time enough to talk about sin, Nimue, when you are capable of doing it, or making choices between good and evil.
Nimue got on her pony obediently, but after a time she said, Aunt Morgaine, I'm not such a good girl, though. I sin all the time. I'm always doing wicked things. I'm not at all surprised that Mother wanted to send me away. That's why she's sending me to a wicked place, because I'm a wicked girl.
Morgaine felt her throat close with something like agony. She had been about to mount her own horse, but she hurried to Nimue's pony and caught the girl in a great hug, holding her tight and kissing her again and again. She said breathlessly, Never say that again, Nimue. Never. It isn't true. I vow to you it isn't. Your mother didn't want to send you away at all, and if she had thought Avalon a wicked place, she wouldn't have sent you no matter what I threatened.
Nimue said in a small voice, Why am I being sent away, then?
Morgaine still held her tight with all the strength of her arms.
Because you were pledged to Avalon before you were born, my child. Because your grandmother was a priestess. And because I have no daughter for the goddess. And you are being sent to Avalon that you may learn wisdom and serve the goddess.
She noted that her tears were falling unheeded on Nimue's fair hair.
Who let you believe it was punishment?
One of the women. Well, she packed my shift.
Nimue faltered.
I heard her say, Mother should not have sent me to that wicked place. And Father Griffin has told me often I'm a wicked girl.
Morgaine sank to the ground, holding Nimue in her lap, rocking her back and forth.
No, no, she said gently. No, darling, no. You are a good girl. If you are naughty or lazy or disobedient, that isn't sin. It's only that you're not old enough to know any better. And when you are taught to do what is right, then you will do so. And then, because she thought this conversation had gone far for a child so young, she said, Look at that butterfly. I haven't seen one that colour before. Come, Nimue, let me lift you on your pony now, she said, and listened attentively as the little girl chattered on about butterflies.
Alone, she could have ridden to Avalon in a single day, but the short legs of Nimue's little pony couldn't make that distance, so they slept that night in a clearing. Nimue had never slept out of doors before, and the darkness frightened her when they put out the fire. So Morgaine let the child creep into the circle of her arms, and lay pointing out one star after another to her. The little girl was tired with riding and soon slept, but Morgaine lay awake, Nimue's head heavy on her arm, feeling fear stealing upon her. She had been so long away from Avalon. Step by slow step she had retraced all her training, or what she could remember, but would she forget some vital thing? At last she slept. But before morning it seemed that she heard a step in the clearing, and Raven stood before her. She wore her dark gown and spotted deerskin tunic, and she said, Morgaine, Morgaine, my dearest. Her voice, the voice Morgaine had heard but once in all her years in Avalon, was so filled with surprise and joy and wonder that Morgaine woke suddenly, and stared round the clearing, half expecting to see Raven there in the flesh. But the clearing was empty, except for a trace of mist that blotted out the stars, and Morgaine lay down again, not knowing if she had dreamed, or whether, with the sight, Raven knew that she was approaching. Her heart was racing. She could feel the beat of it almost painful inside her chest.
I should never have stayed away so long. I should have tried to return when Vivian died. Even if I died in the attempt, I should have made it.
Will they want me now, old, worn, used, the sight slowly going from me, with nothing to bring them? The child at her side made a small, sleepy sound and stirred. She shifted her weight slightly and moved closer into Morgaine's arms. Morgaine put an arm round her, thinking, I bring them Vivian's granddaughter. But if they let me return only for her sake, it will be more bitter than death. Has the goddess cast me out forever? At last she slept again, not to waken until it was broad daylight, misty drizzle beginning to fall. With this bad start, the day went badly. Toward midday, Nimue's pony cast a shoe, and although Morgaine was impatient and would have taken the child up to ride before her, she herself was the lightest of burdens for a horse who could have carried two her size without trouble. She didn't want to lame the pony, so they must turn aside for a village and a blacksmith. She didn't want it known or rumoured in the countryside that the king's sister rode for Avalon, but now there was no help for it. There was so little news in this part of the land that whatever happened here seemed to fly on wings. Well, it couldn't be helped. The wretched little animal wasn't to blame. They delayed and found a small village off the main road. All day the rain fell, even though it was high summer. Morgaine was shivering, and the child was damp and fretful. Morgaine paid little attention to her fussing. She was sorry for her, especially when Nimue began to cry softly for her mother, but that couldn't be helped either, and one of the first lessons of a priestess in the making was to endure loneliness. She would simply have to cry until she found her own comfort, or learn to live without it, as all the maidens in the house had had to learn to do. It was now long past noon, although the overcast was so thick that they could get no hint of the sun. Still, at this time of year the light lingered late, and Morgaine didn't want to spend another night on the road. She resolved to ride as far as they could see their way, and was encouraged to see that as soon as they began to ride again, Nimue stopped whimpering and began to take an interest in what they rode past. Now they were very near Avalon. Nimue was so sleepy that she swayed in her saddle, and at last Morgaine lifted the little girl from her pony and held her in front of her on the saddle. But the child woke when they came to the shores of the lake.
"Are we there, aunt?" she asked as she was set on her feet. "No, but it isn't far now," Morgaine said. "Within half an hour, if all goes well, you will be ready for supper and bed." "And if all doesn't go well?"
Morgaine refused to think of that. Doubt was fatal to power, and to the sight. 5 years she had spent laboriously retracing her steps from the beginning. Now it was as it had been before, cast out of Avalon, with no test save this. Have I the power to return?
I don't see anything at all, Nimue said. Is this the place? But there is nothing here, aunt.
And she looked fearfully at the dismal dripping shore, the solitary reeds murmuring to the rain.
They will send us a boat, said Morgaine. But how will they know we are here? How can they see us in this rain?
I will call it, said Morgaine. Be quiet, Nimue. Within her echoed the fretful child's cry. But now, when she stood at last on the shores of home, she felt the old knowledge welling up, filling her like a cup overrunning its brim. She bent her head for an instant in the most fervent prayer of her life, then drew a long breath and raised her arms in invocation. For an instant, heart sick with failure, she felt nothing.
Then, like a slowly descending line of light running down her, it struck through her, and she heard the little girl at her side gasp in sudden wonder. But she had no time for that. She felt her body like a bridge of lightning between heaven and earth. She didn't consciously speak the word of power, but felt it throbbing like thunder through her whole body. Silence. Silence, Nimue white and dumb at her side. And then, in the dim, dull waters of the lake, there was a little stirring, like mist boiling. And then a shadow, and then long and dark and shining, the Avalon barge moving slowly out of the patch of mist. Morgaine let her breath go in a long sigh that was half a sob. It glided, noiseless as a shadow, to the shore. But the sound of the boat scraping on the land was very real and solid. Several of the little dark men scrambled out and took the horses' heads, bowing low to Morgaine and saying, "I will lead them by the other path, lady," and vanishing into the rain. Another drew back so that Morgaine could first step into the boat, lift the staring child in after her, give a hand to the frightened servants. Still in silence, except for the muttered words of the man who had taken the horses, the boat glided out into the lake.
"What is that shadow, aunt?"
Nimue whispered, as the oars shoved out from the shore. "It is Glastonbury Church," said Morgaine, surprised that her voice was so calm. "It is on the other island, the one we can see from here. Your grandmother, your father's mother, is buried there. Some day, perhaps, you will see her memorial stone."
"Are we going there?"
"Not today."
"But the boat is going straight toward it. I've heard there's a convent on Glastonbury too."
"No," said Morgaine, "we aren't going there. Wait and see, and be quiet." Now would come the true test. They might have seen her from Avalon with the sight and sent the boat, but whether she could open the mists to Avalon, that would be the test of all she had done in these years. She mustn't try and fail. She must simply arise and do it without stopping to think. They were now in the very centre of the lake, where another stroke of the oars would take them into the current which ran toward the Isle of Glastonbury. Morgaine rose swiftly, the flow of her draperies around her, and raised her arms. Again she remembered. It was like the first time she had done this, with a shock of surprise that the tremendous flow of power was silent, when it should blast the sky with thunders. She dared not open her eyes until she heard Nimue cry aloud in fear and wonder. The rain was gone, and under the last brilliance of a setting sun, the Isle of Avalon lay green and beautiful before them, sunlight on the lake, sunlight striking through the ring stones atop the tor, sunlight on the white walls of the temple. Morgaine saw it through a blur of tears. She swayed in the boat and would have fallen except for a hand laid on her shoulder. "Home, home, I am here, I am coming home." She felt the boat scrape on the pebbled shore and composed herself. It seemed not right that she shouldn't be wearing the garb of a priestess, though beneath her gown, as always, Vivian's little knife was belted close around her waist. It seemed not right, her silken veils, the rings on her narrow fingers. Queen Morgaine of North Wales, not Morgaine of Avalon. Well, that could be changed. She lifted her head proudly, drawing a long breath, and took the child by the hand. However she had changed, however many years that lay between, she was Morgaine of Avalon, priestess of the great goddess. Beyond that lake of mists and shadows, she might be queen to an elderly and laughable king in a country far away. But here she was priestess, and born of the old royal line of Avalon. She saw without surprise, as she stepped on land, that before her stood a line of bowing servants, and behind them, awaiting her, the dark-robed forms of priestesses. They had known and had come to welcome her home. And through the line of priestesses she saw a face and form she had seen only in a dream. A tall woman, fair-haired and queenly, her golden hair braided low on her forehead. The woman came to Morgaine quickly through the line of the other priestesses and took her into an embrace. "Welcome, kinswoman," she said softly. "Welcome home, Morgaine." And Morgaine spoke the name she had heard only in dreams, till Kevin spoke it to her, confirming the dream. "I greet you, Ninian, and I bring you Vivian's granddaughter. She shall be fostered here, and her name is Nimue." Ninian was studying her curiously. What had she heard, Morgaine wondered, in all these years? But then she looked away and stooped to look at the little girl. "And this is Galahad's daughter?"
"No," said Nimue. "Galahad is my brother. I am the daughter of the good knight, Lancelot."
Ninian smiled.
"I know," she said. "But here we do not use the name the Saxons gave your father, and he has the same name as your brother, you see. Well, Nimue, have you come to be a priestess here?"
Nimue looked around at the sunset landscape.
"That is what my Aunt Morgaine told me. I would like to learn to read and write and play the harp, and know about the stars and all kinds of things as she does." "Are you really evil sorceresses here? I thought a sorceress would be old and ugly, and you are very pretty."
She bit her lip.
"I'm being rude again."
Ninian laughed. "Always speak out the truth, child.
Yes, I am a sorceress. I do not think I am ugly, but you must decide for yourself whether I am good or evil. I try to do the will of the goddess, and that is all anyone can do." "I'll try to do that, if you'll tell me how," Nimue said.
The sun dropped below the horizon, and suddenly the shore was all grey twilight. Ninian signalled. A servant holding a single torch reached out to another, and the light passed swiftly from hand to hand until the shore was all ablaze with torchlight. Ninian patted the little girl on the cheek. She said, "Until you are old enough to know her will for yourself, will you obey the rules here, and obey the women who have you in charge?"
"I'll try," Nimue said, "but I'm always forgetting. And I ask too many questions."
"You may ask as many questions as you want to, when it is the proper time for such things," Ninian said. "But you have been riding all day, and it is late. So for tonight, the first command I give you is to be a good girl, and go and have supper, and a bath, and go to your bed. Say farewell to your kinswoman now, and go with Leanna to the House of Maidens." She gestured to a sturdy, motherly-looking woman in the dress of a priestess. Nimue sniffled a little and said,
"Must I say goodbye now?
Won't you come and tell me goodbye tomorrow, Aunt Morgaine? I thought I would be with you here." Morgaine said very gently, "No, you must go to the House of Maidens and do what you are told." She kissed the petal's soft cheek. "The goddess bless you, darling. We will meet again when she wills it." And as she spoke, she saw this same Nimue grown to tall womanhood, pale and serious, with a blue crescent painted between her brows, and the shadow of the death crone. She swayed, and Ninian put out a hand to support her.
"You are weary, Lady Morgaine. Send the babe to her rest, and come with me. We can talk tomorrow."
Morgaine printed a final kiss on Nimue's brow, and the little girl trotted away obediently at Leanna's side. Morgaine felt a darkening mist before her eyes. Ninian gave her an arm and said,
"Lean on me.
Come with me to my quarters, where you can rest." Ninian brought her to the dwelling that had once been Vivian's, and to the little room where the priestesses in attendance on the Lady of the Lake slept in their turn. Alone, Morgaine managed to collect herself,
For a moment, she wondered if Ninian had brought her to these quarters to emphasize that she, not Morgaine, was Lady of the Lake. Then stopped herself. That kind of intrigue was for the court, not for Avalon. Ninian had simply given her the most convenient and secluded of the rooms available. Once Raven had dwelt here in her consecrated silence, so that Vivian might teach her. Morgaine washed the grime of travel from her weary body, wrapped herself in the long robe of undyed wool which she found lying across the bed, and even ate some of the food they brought, but didn't touch the warmed and spiced wine. There was a stone water jar at the side of the fireplace, and she dipped out a ladleful, drinking, with tears in her eyes. The priestesses of Avalon drink only water from the sacred well. Again she was the young Morgaine, sleeping within the walls of her own place. She went to bed and slept like a child. She never knew what woke her. There was a step in the room, and silence. By the last flicker of the dying firelight and the flooding light of the moon through the shutters, she saw a veiled form, and for a moment she thought that Ninian had come to speak with her. But the hair that flowed over the shoulders was long and dark, and the dark face beautiful and still. On one hand she could see the darkened, thickened patch of an ancient scar. Raven. She sat up and said, "Raven, is it you?" Raven's fingers covered her lips in the old gesture of silence. She came to Morgaine's side, bent over her, and kissed her. Without a word, she threw off her long cloak and lay down at Morgaine's side, taking her in her arms. In the dimness, Morgaine could see the rest of the scars running up along the arm and across the pale, heavy breast. Neither of them spoke a word then, nor in the time that followed. It seemed that the real world and Avalon had both slipped away. And again she was in the shadows of the fairy country, held close in the arms of the lady. Morgaine heard in her mind the words of the ancient blessing of Avalon, as Raven touched her slowly with ritual silence and significance, and the sound seemed to shiver around her in the silence. "Blessed be the feet that have brought you to this place. Blessed the knees that shall bend before her altar. Blessed be the gate of life." And then the world began to flow and change and move around her, and for a moment it wasn't Raven in the silence, but a form edged in light, whom she had seen once, years before, at the time when she crossed the great silence. And Morgaine knew that she too was glowing in light, still the deep, flowing silence. And then it was only Raven again, lying close to her with her hair perfumed with the herbs they used in the rites, one arm flung over her, her silent lips just touching Morgaine's cheek. Morgaine could see that there were long, pale streaks of white in the dark hair. Raven stirred and raised herself. Still, she didn't speak, but she took from somewhere a silver crescent, the ritual ornament of a priestess. Morgaine knew, with a catch of breath, that it was the one she had left on her bed in the House of Maidens on the day when she had fled forth from Avalon with Arthur's child in her womb. Silent, after a gasp of half-voiced protest, she let Raven bind it about her neck. But Raven showed her briefly, by the last glint of the setting moon, the flash of a knife blade bound about her own waist. Morgaine nodded, knowing that Vivian's ritual knife would never again, while she lived, leave her side. She was content that Raven should bear the one she herself had abandoned, until one day she saw it bound about Nimue's waist. Raven took the little razor-sharp knife, and Morgaine watched, stilled into a dream as she raised it. "So be it. Even if she wishes here to shed my blood before the goddess, I tried to flee." But Raven turned the knife toward her own throat. From the breastbone she pricked a single drop of blood, and Morgaine, bowing her head, took the knife and made a slight cut over her heart.
"We are old, Raven and I. We shed blood no longer from the womb, but from the heart."
And wondered afterwards what she had meant. Raven bent to her and licked the blood away from the small cut. Morgaine bent and touched her lips to the small welling stain at Raven's breast, knowing that this was a sealing long past the vows she had taken when she came to womanhood. Then Raven drew her again into her arms.
"I gave up my maidenhood to the Horned One. I bore a child to the god. I burned with passion for Lancelot, and Accolon created me priestess anew in the ploughed fields, which the spring maiden had blessed. Yet never have I known what it was to be received simply in love."
It seemed to Morgaine, half in a dream, that she lay in the lap of her mother, no, not Igraine, but welcomed back into the arms of the great mother. When she woke, she was alone. Opening her eyes into the sunlight of Avalon, weeping with joy, she wondered for a moment if she had dreamed. Yet over her heart was a small stain of dried blood, and on the pillow beside her lay the silver crescent, the ritual jewel of a priestess, which she had left when she had fled from Avalon. Yet surely Raven had bound it about her throat. Morgaine tied it around her neck on its slender thong. It would never leave her again. Like Vivian, she would be buried with this about her neck. Her fingers shook as she knotted the leather, knowing that this was a re-consecration. There was something else on the pillow, and for a moment it shifted and changed. An unopened rosebud, a full-blown rose. And when Morgaine took it into her hand, it was the rose-hip berry, full and round and crimson, pulsing with the tart life of the rose. As she watched, it shrank, withered, lay dried in her hand, and Morgaine suddenly understood. "Flower and even fruit are only the beginning. In the seed lies the life and the future." With a long sigh, Morgaine tied the seed into a scrap of silk, knowing that she must go forth again from Avalon. Her work was not completed, and she had chosen the place of her work and her testing when she fled forth from Avalon. One day, perhaps, she might return, but that time hadn't come yet. "And what I am must be hidden, as the rose lies hidden within the seed." She rose then, and put on the garments of the queen. The robe of a priestess should be hers again one day, but she had yet to earn again the right to wear it. Then she sat and waited for Ninian to summon her. When she came into the central room where she had faced Vivian so often, time swooped and circled and turned on itself, so that for a moment it seemed to Morgaine that she must see Vivian sitting where she had so often sat, dwarfed by the high seat, and yet impressive, filling the whole room. Then she blinked, and it was Ninian there, tall and slight and fair. It seemed to Morgaine that Ninian was no more than a child sitting in play in the high seat. And then what Vivian had said to her when she stood before her so many years ago suddenly rushed over her. "You have reached a stage where obedience may be tempered with your own judgment." And for a moment it seemed to her that her best judgment was to turn aside now, to say to Ninian only such words as might reassure her. And then the surge of resentment came over her at the thought that this child, this foolish and ordinary girl in the dress of a priestess, was presuming to sit where Vivian had sat, and to give orders in the name of Avalon. She had been chosen only because she was the blood of Taliesin. "How does she dare sit here and presume to give orders to me?" She looked down at the girl, knowing, without being certain, how that she had taken upon herself the old glamour and majesty. And then, with a sudden surge of the sight, it seemed to her that she read Ninian's thoughts. "She should be here in my place," Ninian was thinking. "How can I speak with authority to Queen Morgaine of the Fairies?
and the thought was blurred, half with awe of the strange and powerful priestess before her, and half with simple resentment. If she had not fled from us and forsworn her duty, I wouldn't now be struggling to fill a place for which we both know I am not fit. Morgaine came and took her hands, and Ninian was surprised at her gentle voice. "I am sorry, my poor girl. I would give my very life to return here and take the burden from you. But I cannot. I dare not. I cannot hide here and shirk my given task because I long for my home." It was no longer arrogance nor contempt for the girl who had been thrust unwillingly into the place which should have been hers, but simple pity for her. "I have begun a task in the West Country which must be completed. If I leave it half done, it were better it had never been begun. You cannot take my place there, and so, may the goddess help us both, you must keep my place here." She bent and embraced the girl, holding her tight. "My poor little cousin, there is a fate on us both, and we cannot escape it. If I had stayed here, the goddess would have worked with me one way, but even when I tried to flee my sworn duty, she brought it upon me elsewhere. None of us can escape. We are both in her hands, and it is too late to say it would have been better the other way. She will do with us as she will." Ninian held rigidly aloof for a moment, then her resentment melted, and she clung to Morgaine almost as Nimue had done. Blinking back tears, she said, "I wanted to hate you."
"And I you, perhaps," Morgaine said.
"But she has willed otherwise, and before her we are sisters." Hesitantly, her lips reluctant to speak the words which had been withheld for so long, she added something else, and Ninian bent her head and murmured the proper response. Then she said, "Tell me of your work in the West, Morgaine. No, sit here beside me. There is no rank between us. You know that." When Morgaine had told her what she could, Ninian nodded. "Something of this I heard from the Merlin," she said. "In that country, then, men turn again to the old worship. But Uriens has two sons, and the elder is his father's heir. Your task, then, is to make certain that Wales has a king from Avalon, which means that Accolon must succeed his father, Morgaine." Morgaine closed her eyes and sat with bent head. At last she said, "I will not kill Ninian. I have seen too much of war and bloodshed. Avaloch's death would solve nothing. They follow Roman ways there now, since the priests have come. And Avaloch has a son." Ninian dismissed that. "A son who could be reared to the old worship? How old is he? 4 years old?"
"He was so when I came to Wales," said Morgaine,
thinking of the child who had sat in her lap and clung to her with his sticky fingers and called her granny.
"Enough, Ninian. I have done all else. But even for Avalon, I will not kill."
Ninian's eyes flamed blue sparks at her. She raised her head and said, warning, "Never name that well from which you will not drink." And suddenly, Morgaine realized that the woman before her was priestess too, not merely the pliant child she had seemed. She couldn't be where she was. She could never have passed the tests and ordeals which went into the making of a lady of Avalon, if she had not been acceptable to the goddess. With unexpected humility, she realized why she had been sent there. Ninian said, almost in warning, "You will do what the goddess wills when her hand is laid upon you, and that I know by the token you bear." And her eyes rested upon Morgaine's bosom, as if she could see through the folds of the gown to the seed which lay there, or to the silver crescent on its leather thong. Morgaine bent her head and whispered, "We are all in her hands."
"Be it so," said Ninian.
And for a moment it was so silent in the room that Morgaine could hear the splash of a fish in the lake beyond the borders of the little house. Then she said,
What of Arthur Morgaine?
He bears still the sword of the Druid Regalia. Will he honour his oath at last?
Can you make him honour it?
I do not know Arthur's heart, Morgaine said, and it was a bitter confession.
I had power over him, and I was too squeamish to use it. I flung it away.
He must swear again to honour his oath to Avalon, or you must get the sword from him again, said Ninian. And you are the only person living to whom this task might be entrusted. Excalibur, the sword of the Holy Regalia, must not remain in the hands of one who follows Christ. You know Arthur has no son by his queen, and he has named the son of Lancelot, Galahad by name, to be his heir, since now the queen grows old.
Morgaine thought, Guinevere is younger than I, and I might still bear a child if I had not been so damaged in Gwydion's birth. Why are they so certain she will never bear?
But before Ninian's certainty, she asked no questions. There was magic enough in Avalon, and no doubt they had hands and eyes at Arthur's court. And indeed, the last thing they would wish would be that the Christian Guinevere should bear Arthur a son. Not now.
Arthur has a son, said Ninian, and while his day is not yet, there is a kingdom he can take. A place to begin the recapture of this land for Avalon. In the ancient ways, the king's son meant little. The son of the lady was all, and the king's sister's son was his heir. Know you what I mean, Morgaine?
Accolon must succeed to the throne of Wales. Morgaine heard it again, and then what Ninian didn't say. And my son is the son of King Arthur. Now it all made sense, even her own barrenness after Gwydion's birth. But she asked, what of Arthur's heir, Lancelot's son? Ninian shrugged, and for a moment Morgaine wondered, horrified, whether it was intended to give Nimue the same hold on Galahad's conscience that she had been given on Arthur's.
I cannot see all things, said Ninian. Had you been lady here... But time has moved on, and other plans must be made. Arthur may yet honour his oath to Avalon, and keep the sword Excalibur, and then there will be one way to proceed. And he may not, and there will be another way which she will prepare, to which end we each have our tasks. But whether or no, Accolon must come to rule in the West Country, and that is your task, and the next king will rule from Avalon. When Arthur falls, though his stars say he will live to be old, then the king of Avalon will rise. Or else, the stars say, such darkness will fall over this land that it will be as if he had never been. And when the next king takes power, then will Avalon return into the mainstream of time and history. And then there will be a subject king over the western lands, ruling his tribe's people. Accolon shall rise high as your consort, and it is for you to prepare the land for the great king from Avalon. Again Morgaine bowed her head and said, I am in your hands. You must return now, said Ninian. But first there is one you must know.
His time is not yet. There will be one more task for you. She raised her hand, and as if he had been waiting in an anteroom, a door opened, and a tall young man came into the room. And at the sight, Morgaine caught her breath, with a pain so great that it seemed for a moment that she couldn't breathe. Here was Lancelot reborn, young and slender as a dark flame, his hair curling about his cheeks, his narrow dark face smiling. Lancelot, as he had been on that day when they lay together in the shadow of the ring stones, as if time had slipped and circled back, as in the fairy country. And then she knew who it must be. He came forward and bent to kiss her hand. His walk was Lancelot's, too, the flowing movements that seemed almost a dance. But he wore the robes of a bard,
and on his forehead was the small tattoo of an acorn crest, and about his wrists the serpents of Avalon writhed. Time reeled in her mind. If Galahad is to be king in the land, is my son then the Merlin, tarnished and dark twin and sacrifice? For a moment it seemed she moved among shadows, king and druid, the bright shadow who sat beside Arthur's throne as queen, and herself who had borne Arthur's shadow son, dark lady of power. She knew anything she said would be foolish. Gwydion, you are not like your father. He shook his head. No, he said, I bear the blood of Avalon. I looked once on Arthur when he made a pilgrimage to Glastonbury of the priests. I went there unseen in a priest's robe. He bows over much to the priests, this Arthur, our king. His smile was fleeting, feral. You have no reason to love either of your parents, Gwydion, said Morgaine, and her hand tightened on his, but she surprised a fleeting look in his eyes, icy hatred. Then it was gone, and he was the smiling young druid again. My parents gave me their best gift, Gwydion said, the royal blood of Avalon. And one more thing I ask of you, Lady Morgaine. Irrationally, she wished he had called her just once by the name of Mother. Ask, and if I can give, it is yours. Gwydion said, It isn't a great gift. Surely not more than 5 years hence, Queen Morgaine. You will lead me to look on Arthur, and let him know that I am his son. I am aware, a quick, disturbing smile, that he cannot acknowledge me as his heir. But I wish him to look on the face of his son. I ask no more than that. She bent her head. Surely I owe you that much, Gwydion. Guinevere might think what she liked. Arthur had already done penance for this. No man could be other than proud of this grave and priestly young druid. Nor should she, after all these years she knew it, feel shame for what had been, as now she knew she had felt it all these years since she had fled from Avalon. Now that she saw her son grown, she bowed before the inevitability of Vivian's sight. She said, I vow to you that day will come. I swear it by the sacred well. Her eyes blurred, and angrily she blinked back the rebellious tears. This wasn't her son. Owain, perhaps, was her son, but not Gwydion. This dark, handsome young man, so like the Lancelot she had loved as a girl. He wasn't her son looking for the first time on the mother who had abandoned him before he was weaned. He was priest, and she priestess of the great goddess. And if they were no more to each other than that, at least they were no less. She put her hands to his bent head and said, Be thou blessed. Chapter 13 Queen Morgawse had long ceased to repine that she hadn't the sight. Yet twice in the last days of falling leaves, when the red larch trees stood bare in the icy wind that blew over Lothian, she dreamed of her foster son, Gwydion, and she wasn't at all surprised when one of her servant folk told her that a rider was on the road. Gwydion wore a strangely coloured cloak, coarse, and with a clasp of bone such as she had never seen, and when she would have wrapped him in her arms, he shrank away, wincing. No, mother. He put his free arm around her and explained, I caught a sword cut there in Brittany. No, it isn't serious, he reassured her. It didn't fester, and perhaps I shall not even have a scar. But when it is touched, it cries out to me.
You've been fighting in Brittany, then? I thought you safe in Avalon, she remonstrated, as she led him within and set him by the fire. I have no southern wine for you.
He laughed. I am weary of it. Barley beer is enough for me. Or some of the fire water, if you have it, with hot water and honey, if there is any. I'm stiff with riding. He let one of the women draw off his boots and hang his cloak to dry, leaning back at ease.
"So good it is to be here, Mother."
He set the steaming cup to his lips and drank with pleasure.
"And you came so far, riding in the cold with a wound? Was there some great tidings that needed to tell?"
He shook his head.
"None. I was homesick, no more," he said. "It's all so green and lush and damp there, with fog and church bells. I longed for the clean air of the fells and the gull's cry, and your face, Mother."
He reached out for the cup he had set down, and she saw the serpents about his wrists. She wasn't greatly versed in the lore of Avalon, but she knew they were the sign of the highest rank of the priesthood. He saw her glance and nodded, but said nothing.
"Was it in Brittany you got you that ugly cloak, so coarse-worn and low, fit only for a serving man?"
He chuckled.
"It kept the rain from me.
I took it from a great chief of the foreign lands, who fought under the legions of that man who called himself Emperor Lucius. Arthur's men made short work of that one, believe me, and there was plunder for all. I have a silver cup and a golden ring in my packs for you, Mother."
"You fought in the armies of Arthur?" Morgause asked. She had never thought he would do this.
He saw the surprise in her face and laughed again.
"Yes. I fought under that great king who fathered me," he said, with a grin of contempt. "Oh, fear not. I had my orders from Avalon. I took care to fight among the warriors of Shardig, the Saxon chief of the treaty men who loves me well, and to come not under Arthur's eyes. Gawain knew me not, and I was careful not to let Gareth see me, except when I was shrouded in a cloak like that. I lost my own cloak in battle, and feared if I was wearing a cloak of Lothian, Gareth would come to look on a wounded countryman. So I got this one."
"Gareth would have known you anywhere," said Morgause.
"And I hope you do not think your foster brother would ever betray you."
Gwydion smiled, and Morgause thought that he looked very like the little boy who had once sat in her lap. He said,
"I long to make myself known to Gareth, and when I lay wounded and weak, I came near to doing so. But Gareth is Arthur's man, and he loves his king. I could see that, and I wouldn't put that burden on my best of brothers," he said. "Gareth. Gareth is the only one..."
He didn't finish the sentence, but Morgause knew what he would have said. Stranger as he was everywhere, Gareth was his brother and his beloved friend. Abruptly he grinned, chasing away the remote smile that made him look so young.
"All through the Saxon armies, Mother, I was asked again and again if I was Lancelot's son. I cannot see the resemblance so much myself, but then I'm not really familiar with my own face. I look into a mirror only when I shave myself."
"Still," said Morgause, "anyone who had seen Lancelot, especially anyone who knew him in youth, couldn't look on you without knowing you his kinsman."
"Some such thing as that I said. I put on a Breton accent sometimes, and said I too was kinsman to old King Ban," Gwydion said. "Yet I would think our Lancelot, with the face which makes him a magnet to all maids, would have fathered enough bastards, that it wouldn't be such a marvel to all men that one should go about wearing his face. Not so?
I wondered," he said.
"But all I heard of Lancelot was that it might be that he had fathered a son on the queen, and the child was spirited away somewhere to be fostered by that kinswoman of hers whom they married off to Lancelot. Tales of Lancelot and the queen are many, each wilder than the next, but all agree that for every other woman the gods made, he has nothing but courtesy and fair words. There were even women who flung themselves at me, saying that if they could not have Lancelot, they would have his son."
He grinned again.
"It must have been hard for the gallant Lancelot. I have eye enough for a fair woman, but when they push themselves on me so, well..."
He shrugged comically. Morgause laughed. Then the Druids haven't robbed you of that, my son.
By no means, he said. But most women are fools, so that I prefer not to trouble myself making play with those who expect me to treat them as something very special, or to pay heed to what they say. You have spoilt me for foolish women, mother.
Pity the same couldn't have been said of Lancelot, said Morgause.
For never did anyone think Guinevere had more wits than she needed to keep her girdle tied. And where Lancelot was concerned, I doubt she had that much.
And she thought, you have Lancelot's face, my boy, but you have your mother's wit. As if he had heard her thoughts, he set down the empty cup and waved away a serving girl who would have scurried to refill it.
No more. I'm so weary I will be drunk at another taste. Supper I would have. I have had enough of hunter's fortune. I am sick of meat, and long for home food, porridge and bannock.
Mother, I looked on the Lady Morgaine at Avalon before I left for Brittany.
Now why, Morgause wondered, does he say this to me?
It couldn't be looked for that he should have much love for his mother.
And then she felt sudden guilt. I made sure he shouldn't love any but me. Well, she had done what she must, and she didn't regret it.
How looks my kinswoman?
She looks not young, said Gwydion. It seemed to me that she was older than you, mother.
No, Morgause said.
Morgaine is younger than I by 10 years. Still, she looks worn and old. And you?
He smiled at her, and Morgause felt the flood of sudden happiness. She thought,
none of my own sons have I loved as this one. Morgaine did well to leave him to my care.
Oh, she said, I grow old too, my lad. I had a grown son when you were born.
Then you are twice the sorceress she is, said Gwydion, for one could swear you had dwelt long in the fairy country, with time never touching you. You look to me as you did the day I rode away for Avalon, mother mine.
He reached out his hand to hers, and brought it to his lips, and kissed it. And she came and put her arm round him, careful to avoid his wound. She stroked the dark hair.
So Morgaine is queen now in Wales.
True,
Gwydion said,
and high, I hear, in favour with the king. Arthur has made her stepson, Uwain, a member of his own personal bodyguard, next to Gawain. And he and Gawain are close friends. Uwain's not a bad fellow. Not unlike Gawain, I'd say, tough and staunch, both of them, and devoted to Arthur, as if the sun rose and set where he pissed.
And Morgause noted the wry smile.
But then it's a fault many men have.
And I came here to speak of this to you, mother, he said. Know you anything of Avalon's plan?
I know what Ninian said, and the Merlin, when they came to take you thither, said Morgause.
I know you are to be Arthur's heir, even though he believes he will leave the kingdom to that son of Lancelot's.
I know you are the young stag who will bring down the king stag, she said, in the old language.
And Gwydion raised his brow.
Then you know it all, he said.
But this, perhaps, you do not know. It cannot be done now.
Since Arthur brought down this Roman who would be emperor, this Lucius, his star has never flamed higher than now. Anyone who raised a hand against Arthur would be torn in pieces by the mob or by his companions. Never have I seen a man so loved.
This, I think, is why I needed to look from afar on his face. To see what is it in a king which makes him so loved.
His voice fell away into silence, and Morgause felt ill at ease.
And did you so?
Gwydion nodded slowly.
He is a king indeed.
Even I, who have no cause to love him, felt that spell he creates around him. You cannot imagine how he is worshipped.
Strange, said Morgause. I, for one, never thought him so remarkable. No, be fair, said Gwydion. There are not many. Perhaps there is no other within this land who could have rallied all factions as he did. Romans, Welsh, Cornish, West Countrymen, East Anglians, men of Brittany, the old people, the men of Lothian. All through this kingdom, mother, all men swear by Arthur's star. Even those Saxons who once fought Uther to the death stand and swear that Arthur shall be their king. He is a great warrior. No, not in himself. He fights no better than any other warrior, not half so well as Lancelot or even Gareth. But he is a great general. And it's something in himself, Gwydion said. It's easy to love him. And while all worship him thus, I have no possible task.
Then, said Morgause, their love of him must somehow be made less. He must be discredited. He is no better than any other man, the gods know that.
He fathered you on his own sister, and it is well known here and abroad that he plays no very noble part with his queen. There is a name for a man who sits complacent while another man pays court to his queen, and not so pretty a name after all.
Something, I am sure, can be made of that, said Gwydion, though in these late years it is said Lancelot has stayed far from court, and taken care never to be alone with the queen, so that no shadow of scandal shall fall on her name.
Yet they say she wept like a child, and so did Lancelot, when he took leave of her to go and fight at Arthur's side against this Lucius. And never did I see man fight as did Lancelot. One would think he longed to fling himself headlong into death. But he took never even a wound, as if his life was charmed.
I wonder. He is the son of a high priestess of Avalon, he mused. It may be he bears supernatural protection of some sort.
Morgaine would know that, said Morgause dryly. But I wouldn't suggest you ask her.
I do know that Arthur's life is charmed, said Gwydion, for he bears the sacred Excalibur, sword of the druid regalia, and a magical scabbard which guards him from shedding blood. Without it, so Ninian told me, he would have bled himself to death at Celloden Wood, and after that.
Morgaine has been given as her first task to get this sword again from Arthur, unless he will swear anew to be true to Avalon. And I doubt not my mother is wily enough to do so. I doubt she would stop at much, my mother. Of the two, I think I like my father better. He knew not what evil he had wrought when he got me, I think.
Morgaine knew not that either, said Morgause sharply.
Oh, I am weary of Morgaine. Even Ninian has fallen under her spell, said Gwydion sharply. Do not you begin to defend her to me, mother.
Morgause thought, Vivian was even so. She could charm any man alive to do her will, and any woman either. Igraine went pliant at her bidding to wed with Gaulois, and later to seduce Uther, and I to Lotsbed. And now Ninian has done what Morgaine wished. And this foster son of hers had, she suspected, something of that power too. She recalled, suddenly, and with unexpected pain, Morgaine with her head bent, having her hair combed like a child, on the night she bore Gwydion. Morgaine, who had been to her as the daughter she never bore. And now she was torn between Morgaine and Morgaine's son, who was even dearer to her than her own sons.
Do you hate her so, Gwydion?
I know not how I feel, said Gwydion,
looking up at her with Lancelot's dark, mournful eyes. It seems not to run with the vows of Avalon that I should so hate the mother who bore me, and the father who got me. I would that I had been reared at court as my father's son, and his sworn follower, not his bitterest enemy.
He laid his head down on his arms and said through them, "I'm weary, Mother. I'm weary."